Welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, where we go inside what makes a coach a coach. The Guardians of the Game podcast is a production of the National Association of Basketball Coaches and Learfield IMG College, brought to you by Wilson Sporting Goods. And now, here's your host, Dave Odom.
Welcome to the new season of the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast. Some people would say we're starting at the top. We've got the coach of the year last year, who coached the national championship Virginia Cavaliers all the way to the crown, the very last game. They won the game. He's got that championship under his belt now, and he's looking ahead to another year. Tony, welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, and thanks for making time for us.
No, thank you, Coach Odom. It's my pleasure to be here, and appreciate all you guys do for the game.
Right off the top, what's life been like since you won the championship? I know it's got to be some challenges. Your life had to have changed a little bit. You've got to try to balance your home life. You got a wife, a great wife. You got kids there. I know you sent a daughter off to Wake Forest to school, and you got some new recruits in. You got to restructure your team. What's life been like?
Yeah, it is busy, but I think first things first, you know, I did take the time to just enjoy my family after the championship and enjoy life. Like, I really did. It was a wonderful moment. You know, you coach hard, you spend so much time, and not everybody gets to experience, you know, the top of the mountain from a vocation standpoint like that. So I made sure I enjoyed it. So when I had time away, you know, we did some real fun stuff, enjoyed it with things with my staff, with my team, and then, of course, with my family. So I think we did that well. And then, you know, the thing that changed a lot is you just saw how it affected people in our community. They were so excited and so thankful. And it did have an impact on, you know, kind of generational. You hear people say, man, I watched the game with my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and myself. And it was just something that brought the community together. And then with that, you know, I guess notoriety, you realize, like, yeah, there's a lot more speaking opportunities or people want stuff, but you're more noticeable. You can't go around Charlottesville without people wanting to, you know, just stop and tell you how wonderful they enjoyed the experience and all that. So I guess you just noticed a little more. But beyond all that, it gets back to what you do. You can't, just like, you know, may I say, success, failure, treat them both in a way as imposters, learn from both, and then just get back to it does not define you. You know, when we were the first, and I didn't know I was going to bring up this early, Coach, when we were the first one seed to lose to your son's team, I think one of the best coaches in the game, and Ryan against UMBC, it was hard. It humbled us. But it still didn't change, you know, who you were, how you tried to coach, and the person you were. It almost refined you, and it's the same on the other side of it. When you win something, you enjoy it, you learn from it, and then, yeah, you get back to who you are and what you like doing and grow. And I think we sometimes, I don't know, think things are going to change so much, and they don't.
Well, I had to remind him not to let it change him either, the other side, because it's a profession that it just humbles you if you don't take care of business each and every day. But I think the fact that you took time to enjoy things with your family and with your community and with your university certainly helped you. You did mention your team, and of course, that's what it's all about, is, you know, trying to get your team, you know, keep them under wraps and, you know, let them enjoy the experiences as well. And at the same time, you've got to have an eye peered towards the next season. So with that in mind, how did you manage helping your team manage the pressure and the expectations that are going to naturally follow you into the next year?
Well, we have such a new team. You know, we're probably we're a little different. We're probably actually more similar to most teams in college basketball. Our goal has always been to build through experienced players, get them experience, get them to be upperclassmen, and be as good as we can. When you're in a league with the likes of, you know, Duke and Carolina and Syracuse, Louisville, and just go down the list, the quality teams in this league, we found success when we've gotten guys into their upperclassmen years. So, you know, last year's team was by design. We took some lumps, but it was built to be good, and with an eye towards really last year with some maturity and this year. And, you know, I'm so thankful that DeAndre Hunter and Ty Jerome and Kyle Guy, you know, they all got drafted. One is a second-year player, and the other two were in their third year. But we thought we were going to, at the start of their careers, I said, well, we're going to have at least two of those three for their whole 4 years, just thinking how it would play out. So we have, you know, when we had such a good year and those guys played at such an elite level and, you know, the success of some players before them in the NBA, I think they got a chance to win a championship, reach their dreams. So then we have to, you know, starting over might be too strong of a word, but we had to find some new players. And so it's a big transition in terms of adding players and playing guys with not a lot of experience. So I'm looking at this year as just, can we build? Can we be as good as we can and get a lot of guys experience and hopefully become the team as the season progresses we want to become and see how far it takes us? That's what we do every year. But it's the most inexperienced team I think I've coached, maybe even in the 11 years I've been here. It's just as far as youth and guys that even who are in the program that really didn't play last year. So that's a unique challenge that, you know, you're thinking about ways to help them. And but knowing with a long range view of them, they're going to improve. And it's just like when Kyle and Ty and DeAndre were in their first year, they took their lumps, but because of it, they became good.
Well, I had this question tabbed for a little bit later in the program, but I'll go ahead and ask it now since you kind of brought it up. When you recruit, Tony, I know you prefer, as most coaches do, to have players that are very good when they come in. They're skilled, they're athletic, they've got good skills, and they want to learn, and they're dedicated to being good students, and you want to try to progress them into their second, third, and even their fourth year. Do you recruit with that in mind? And if you do, does that mean that you kind of stay away from those that are logically going to be there for 1 year and then off to the pros?
That's what we've always done, always. And, you know, I think Mike Bray says, you know, get old, stay old. That's kind of his motto. I watched my father build programs. I played for him at Wisconsin Green Bay. It was a Division II, and then it went to Division I, so they had to start over. I saw him rebuild the program at Wisconsin, which was, you know, in a real bad way. And then I watched him do it at Washington State, which was remarkable what he did. And it was really that formula, and he did it. So that absolutely is our formula. And our guys, we've had actually now a few guys in recent years that have gone early to the NBA. They didn't get recruited like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to be a one and done. We one, don't have usually access to those guys, or you're not going to beat out some of the schools that you get in recruiting battles with. But we've just had guys that they've either really been better than we've thought or people have missed on them, and they've developed quickly, and we've had team success, and all of a sudden, you know what? In their third year or their second year, they have a chance, and they go. That's how it's played out. So the initial intent is, now let's get guys that, if they really are good and develop and have team success, you know, maybe after their third year they could perhaps go. But the intent, you know, now you win a championship or you have success like we've had, been fortunate to, and you know, we've won a number of ACC titles. All right, do you change your mindset? Do you say, hey, maybe we can get involved with a guy that's going to be a one and done? I don't think you change a whole lot. I just think you try to get the best player that fits your program, that wants to be successful in college, that has a dream to play in the NBA, and if they happen to be good enough to go in 3 years, if it takes four, if it takes two, or if they go all 4 years and they don't play, that's the mindset. Because I think it's hard, you know, unless your program's built to recruit that way, one and done, you can get them and then you can replenish it. You can really set your program back. Even us losing guys early, I see the challenges of, you recruit for cycles and that changes the cycle. So it's part of the game. And if a guy's good enough and he goes early, great, but we don't recruit with that in mind, if that makes sense.
It does. You might even ask, why would I change? I mean, we've been successful to a certain degree, coaching and recruiting the way that we have. We've been able to beat some of these teams that pretty much are one and done type programs. Why would we change? I mean, you want to try to keep doing what you do, the way you do it, and the way you're comfortable, and everybody knows when they come in there, this is our goal. It may not happen. It may derail you somewhere along the way, but that is the way we do things, and nobody does it, I don't think, any better in the country than you guys at University of Virginia today. Tony, let's go back.
I want to bring this up because if coaches are listening to this, the challenge in the last number of years that's come, whether you call it the job is to try to get your program, you know, try not to make this, you know, mistakes on recruits. You never get it all right, but get the guys that will be in your program for, you know, whatever, put the number 3 years, hopefully four. The challenge, yeah, if they're good enough and they can go to the NBA, that's one issue. But how do you keep these guys if they either aren't playing as much as they want or just to stick with it so that you can get them to where they don't transfer, they don't leave, that they see enough where at least, okay, now we have more veterans and these guys have learned and developed their game in the right way. That is the challenge. I think every program, even the one-and-done programs, because they have to have those filler guys, but almost the rest of us, how do you keep that core group together? You're going to lose some guys for numbers of reasons, but the core group together for those 3 or 4 years. I think that's what every coach is fighting for, and that's where success can lie when you have those teams that somehow can do it if the guy's a quality player in person.
Let's kind of whiz through your bio as a youth. You obviously grew up in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. You play basketball there. Do you play other sports as well?
I played little league I was a baseball, football, basketball until I got to like junior high. Then I'd play golf. I think my freshman year of high school, I went out to the golf team and made the varsity team. Did that 1 year. But then once I moved from Stevens Point to Wisconsin, to Green Bay, where my dad took that job, and then I just played high school. Then I just stuck to basketball. So, you know, as a youth, you do all that stuff. I never got into hunting as a Wisconsin boy. That was the one thing I never did. I fished a little bit, but otherwise I played the other sports, but locked into basketball in high school.
You were hunting for 3-point shots, what you were hunting for up there, I know. All right, well, look, you mentioned Green Bay. You a big Aaron Rodgers fan or what?
Well, it starts first with Don Majkowski. He's the magic man. He went to UVA. Might have been when you were here. I don't know.
He was. He was.
Was he? Okay, good. So he was there, and I was at the game when he got injured. I was in Lambeau Field, and they brought this young guy in to take over for him named Brett Favre. And then the rest is history because he set the streak after that game for most consecutive games. So I obviously started with him, and then it was Brett Favre. How could you not? And, of course, Aaron Rodgers. But ironically, when I was real little, my dad coached high school basketball in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is right on the Minnesota border. And this is for all the older coaches or people listening. I loved Fran Tarkington, the Minnesota Vikings. He was like my hero as a quarterback. So that's my quarterback progression.
Hmm. I'm gonna give you a moment in time. I don't know if you can remember this or not. My guess is you will not. But I want to give it to you in time. I can't remember the exact year, but your dad was at Green Bay. I was at Wake Forest. We were just about our third year into Wake Forest. We had a young player on our team who had yet to play a single game. He was skinny but tall, and I thought talented. His name was Tim Duncan. That was one thing that I turned out to be right about, at least.
Yes,
we're standing underneath the basket. Either one of us was coming off with our team practicing, getting ready for the game that night. The other one was just getting ready to go on. Your dad and I were in a conversation. As I remember it, you were kneeled down and sitting on a basketball listening to he and I talk. And I said to him, and the reason this came up is because I had the kid Tim Duncan, and I didn't know, but I wanted to help him as best I possibly could. And I said, Dick, when the ball goes into a post guy and your team is on defense, how do you play it? He said, well, we have a saying, I'll never forget it as long as I live. If the ball gets in there, we've made a mistake and we got to get it out. Is that still one of the tenets that maybe you have today? Because I know your team is one of the great post-to-post trap teams in the country.
Yeah. Well, first, I don't remember sitting on the ball and being there. So I thought, yeah, I'm not sure of the time, but that's awesome. But no, you know, I remember, you know, my father has influenced so much in my coaching career. And, you know, he always said, we can't get beat by a post player. That's what he always said. So that's where, you know, they fight to keep it up. But that's where he, and I don't know if it was Coach Fisher or at Michigan, but someone, he said, he watched, he observed, they did a post trap, and it was usually big to big. And that became part of his defensive philosophy because he used to run pressure defense, deny, keep it on one side, and then he made an abrupt change. You know, they'd front the post, flood, you know, all that stuff. He went to what, you know, he said, we're going to run more of the pack defense, which a lot of people know. And actually the name is what we talked about earlier, because he was in Green Bay, the Packers, we're going to call it the pack defense. And obviously it had to do with packing the lane, but you know, all that stuff. But he said, that's kind of a vanilla defense. And he said, I think we need something that, you know, forces turnovers and makes it hard. So that's where he initiated or added that hard, big to big post trap. And I think the idea was, if someone's hurting us, we are getting it out of his hands. So we've used that over the years, some on and off, sometimes all the time. And that has been a staple since I've been coaching, and it's really been effective for us. But, you know, I'd say the game evolves. Every now and then you get offenses are continuing to be creative. You get a really good interior post defender, and you can play one-on-one. And so then it keeps people at home, and you avoid the rotations. And then there's times you want to force turnovers. So I think it's a feel thing, but definitely you can't just be a sieve and let the ball in the post easily, you know, in certain spots. I think you have to hold some ground that way. But that was, yeah, a tenet of his. I can't shoot. I think you guys played in Alaska, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe that was a different time against his Green Bay teams. Maybe when Duncan was there. I don't know if that's where
the same year.
Yeah.
Then I have to fact check
because at that time I was playing in the NBA for the Charlotte Hornets, so I wasn't sitting on a ball in Alaska. That was it. So it could have been somewhere else.
But, why? Yeah, come you mess my story up. It was a good
situation. Fact checking is important in today's day and age. I actually remember watching that, and I remember, I think NC. I can remember the teams in that, but absolutely. Your teams caused so much trouble for him. And I remember playing, when they were at Wisconsin and you were there. But when you go against players as talented as Carolina has bigs or Duke or just name it, there's times you can't stop people one-on-one. And I know the game's evolving more to the spread and the outside guys, but a dominant interior player, you've got to have an answer. Because if they can beat you there, you're going to be in trouble.
You've had lots of awards in your playing career and your coaching career, but there's one that stands out to me, and I want to talk about it just a minute. That is the fact that you are still the NCAA all-time leader in three-point shot accuracy at 53.3. My crack staff here in Winston-Salem pulled that up for me. I'm looking at that. I shouldn't be surprised, but you are. Now, that's quite an achievement, but I want to talk to you about the in-depth part of that three-point shooting. You go back to the year 2016-17, the NCAA average was about 34.8. That was the same in 2017-18. And then last year, it dipped a little bit to 34.1. And the distance, we decided to move it back. Now, I'm not real smart, but I don't understand, if we can't shoot well at one distance, why would we move it back and make it harder? Why would we not let it be part of the game? Explain that to me.
Well, I do think, obviously what you're seeing, I bet you the amount of threes attempted has gone up.
I can tell you that. I had them look that up, too. In 1987, the teams averaged 9.2 threes a game. And in 2019, they averaged 21.9. So you're right. It's 11, almost 12 points difference.
For sure. I think nowadays, I think some of the NBA guys you've watched, Curry, but you go way back, that how deep they can shoot the ball. And then not just the perimeter players that are shooting. Now you're having, the stretch fours and the fives. I coached Aaron Baines at Washington State. And to watch him shoot corner threes in the NBA is beyond my comprehension. And he does it pretty well. And, you just see the game has evolved with space, opening it up, stretching and all the analytics of, that stuff. So I think everyone shoots it. It's interesting. I don't know why they moved it back, but I think initially it's going to separate the so-called men from the boys, because some of our guys shoot, two of our guys last year, Ty Jerome, Kyle Guy, they could shoot it from 24 feet. It didn't matter. But a lot of players, especially some of the bigger players, but a lot of guys, they're toe-the-line three-point shooters. You drop that thing back, a foot, foot and a half, that's different. In practice, we step out of bounds more on the sideline because of that space. We shoot more, even in shooting drills, I'll say, get your foot off the line. They're all over the line because they're just not used to it. When I went from college to the NBA, now that was obviously a bigger jump, but you had to adjust. You couldn't shoot it as much off the move. You had to be set. You had to really adjust and get used to it. So I think, I think less guys will shoot it. It's going to separate some guys. And I just think for a while, I believe the numbers will drop a little bit percentage-wise. I think maybe it did a little bit in the NIT. But I don't know what it's doing for the game. If it's going to – they're talking about spacing. Maybe it'll, allow guys at least from a marker to space. But I'm not sure the reason behind it. With the rules, you don't always know if it's going to improve it, hurt it, what it's going to do. But you just adjust to it. And again, I think it'll separate people in terms of being able to shoot it at the frequency they do and at the accuracy, at least initially, the amount of guys on the floor that will freely shoot it. I think, some programs maybe will say, hey, no problem, let it fly. But for us right now, there's guys that it's a little more of a poke to shoot that far out.
Another thing that's really come to the fore in college basketball on the court is the idea of the replay. A lot of people think that the purists think that we got to make every single call's got to be exactly correct. And I'm one that, I look back in my career and I probably lost two or three games because of bad judgment by officials, but also probably one or two or three of them. How do you stand on this replay thing? I mean, is that okay? I mean, it just seems to me like, and I'm more of a fan now than I ever was, but I look at it and when they blow the whistle and they go to the monitor over and over and over, and you piggyback that with the number of timeouts that we have, 16, 12, 8, 4, oh my goodness, it just disrupts the rhythm of the game.
Yeah, well, some of that is commercials and money and all that, but I think within reason, I think as long as it doesn't get carried away and really bog it down, but there's some just plays that, you do want the right call to be made within reason. If you start allowing so much, and where is that line? That's hard. I don't think you can answer that perfectly, but I think it's okay to an extent, but when we start adding more and more replays and it hurts the flow, it's tough. But as I said, you can benefit from it both ways. So I guess you feel better. You can live with it more as long as it doesn't take too long. If that guy's foot was on the line, that shouldn't have counted as a three. Or, it clearly went off that guy's hand. How are the the New Orleans Saints, if they could replay certain that, like they had been in the Super Bowl last year. So there's certain things that are so defining that I think as long as they can control the amount of time it takes and it's not forever, that I think I am in favor of, but not everything. So I guess that's where I stand on that.
The ACC is one of the leagues that's gone to 20 games. How about that? It just seems to me like they just keep taking away the opportunity for the head coaches to kind of play the kind of schedule that you feel is right for your team.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it does affect it in some ways. There's studies about does it help you for NCAA tournament, things like that. With the launch of the ACC network, that's more inventory, so they have more games, intriguing matchups that are on. We're opening up this year, the start of the season, at Syracuse, because you got to find, pockets to play these games, plus it's the launch of the network. So, those are games for interest. But it does, I think people enjoy, we obviously have the Big Ten ACC matchups, and you have some of those early preseason. You have to, when you're playing 20 conference games, some of those will get sacrificed, and I think, I'll probably align more with you. I like a certain number, but when you go to so much, it makes it harder for the non-conference matchups to be sometimes as intriguing.
Let's talk about a student athlete, the status of the student athlete. They get Pell Grants, they get grants from the government. They get cost of attendance from the individual universities. We've got this name and likeness rights issue that's out there. You just don't find many coaches that are against that type of thing. And I got to wonder, is that because of recruiting? You don't want to ever say I don't want you guys to get money. It's not that. But I just look at it from a coach's standpoint. I mean, I can see down the road, if this thing goes through, you get an agent walking into Tony Bennett's office one day and say, "Coach, what time you practice today?" And you say 3:00. And he said, "Can you move it to 4? Because my student athlete that I represent is going to go to, he's got to go to a car dealership today to make an appearance or something." I just see it being compromised so badly. Where do you stand on that, Tony?
Yeah, well, it can't go to things like that. That wouldn't be good for the game. I really am glad that cost of attendance, stipends, I think those things have been really good changes. And I stand as a coach, you know, you guys and my father, yourself, and then those who went before you, that probably didn't benefit near as much as a coach, and it's gone well. It's been the money that I'm paid. It's so lucrative. There's so many things, and, you know, you see all the things that it's generating for the athletic department, for other sports, for the university. There's some real positives of all the money that's being made. And I think, you know, for the student athletes, you know, as an amateur sport, I get both sides of the argument. And that's why I think if we can find ways that can help our student athletes, especially those in need, but to receive more money in the right ways, absolutely, besides the education, that's huge. I think there is a fine line, and I don't know if people really understand the name and likeness stuff, who really benefits from it. I mean, it's only going to be such a small amount, a select few, from at least my understanding, so I don't know the ins and outs of it, but that it's not going to be quite as much as people think. So are there ways we can, you know, balance it out and help, but still protect the game? This is college. Yes, there's a lot of things that have happened that have made it appear to be professional and some things that are, you know, unsightly, but it's still the amateurism. There's still a purity to it that if we go all the way, you do worry about it escalating to some of the things you said. And there is some stuff in our game that probably needs to be cleaned up, but there's still a lot of good. So I'm a little, I don't know what that line is, but I do get nervous about some of the things that could take it to spots that we lose the pure amateur part of the game. And I think if we can find ways to help out as they've continually done cost attendance and more ways, then I think that's great. But I don't know if you want to make it just a mini pro situation. I think it'd be hard for not just only a few schools would benefit from that. The majority, I think it would be tough, but I don't know how that works. The name and likeness, as I said, it would benefit a few, but it's not going to benefit as many as people think. But, you know, these young student athletes do a lot for the program. I think the universities do a lot for them, but how can they, you know, I get other ways that if they need help or they can generate some more income, and can we just try to be better at that, but not go all the way that it ruins the game? That's the one thing we don't want to do. This game has been such a joy for so many, and for so many people that don't have chances to play professionally on, it's provided opportunities that are amazing. So that we got to keep trying to protect that, but still advance the rights of the student athletes.
And the last thing about the student athlete transfer rule, are you okay with that? Fifth year transfer, transferring without sitting out, that type thing?
I wish, maybe, I don't know if I'm in the norm or if I'm the exception. I wish that, again, there are certain things, you know, bad situations, but I wish if you're going to transfer that you have to sit a year no matter what. Anytime, period. I think it's more of a benefit for, you know, a lot of the low to mid majors. I just look at it because, you know, having played at Green Bay, having watched my father coach and seeing some of the most quality programs that have poured into developing guys to get their programs to where they got a great player that, you know, now they're in their junior and senior year and their program could be really good. All of a sudden they just, boop, they're gone. I think that's hard when, you know, for that. And I think, you know, at least if you have to sit a year the way it was, I think that might, maybe the numbers are escalating. I think it might slow it down a little bit. I mean, it's amazing how many transfers there are. So if it could all, and I don't think it can be because of there's legal action, you can't do that. But if you could have to just sit a year, I would probably vote for that. We've benefited from a guy being able to transfer and play in his fifth year, or, you know, if there's a waiver situation, but it seems like it'd be more in control if it was sitting. And our baseball coach, who I think is one of the best coaches around, said they used to have where you could transfer without sitting. And he said it was like the Wild Wild West. He said they finally adopted more of the older basketball rules where they have to sit. And he said it wasn't perfect, but it certainly controlled some things. And he said, boy, you know, there was talk of you guys going to where they didn't have to sit. And he said, it's just going to become free agency. So, yeah, that's my stand on it. And again, I think that I wish we all had to sit, but I don't think the fifth-year transfer rule from a legal standpoint is going to go away, or I think that's going to stay as is. And that's become part of the game now where you recruit for that. But I think it hurts programs that have poured into these guys, you know, that want to redshirt guys and do certain things.
Tony, last thing, and this is important, I think, to a lot of people that are listening. We've got a lot of young coaches who are aspiring to be where you were, maybe where I've been, and I always try to give our guest a chance to kind of talk to them just a little bit. From an NABC standpoint, whether it's youth clinics or maybe just having a chance to talk to them at summer camp or whatever, what advice would you give some of these young coaches who are trying to move up the coaching ladder each and every year? And sometimes they get discouraged. It's hard. There's a lot of competition there.
No, you're right. It certainly is. And, you know, at first, it's I think you have to understand whether you're so super successful, it's not going to change who you are, or whether you don't have success in the world's eyes or the college basketball's eyes, it's not going to change who you are. You first have to establish, you know, who you are away from the game. I think that is so important. And then you need to establish, okay, why? Everybody talks about that buzzword, why do you do what you do, but why am I coaching? Hopefully it's because you love the game. You enjoy it and you're competitive. And then, man, I actually like the relationships I'm building with the players. You got to keep going back to that, especially during the hard times. And then whatever spot you're in, you try to grow and be as good as you can. And, you know, it's hard. You have to be fortunate to move up the ladder. But man, don't allow the game, your success as a coach, your failure as a coach, or your status and what role you're in to define who you are. Because that deal will get you going sideways. You gotta love what you do. You got to be thankful for it. And remember, you know, like I said, outside of the game, what really matters? I find that the older I get, it's huge to me. And that's why I stand, you know, I watched my father reach his coaching dream of winning a Final Four. He beat Purdue in the year 2000. And I committed his quote to memory because they asked him on the podium in the press conference after, is this the greatest moment of your life? And in that moment, you know, I'm thinking, you know, heck yeah, this is amazing. And I remember what he said. He said, from a feeling state euphoria, he said, perhaps it is. He said, but it doesn't compare with faith, with family, with grandkids. He said, because I know what truly matters, it enables me to enjoy what seems to matter like this. And I think in anything, when you can have somewhat of a balance in where you're at, then you can enjoy, you know, the good things and not be destroyed by the hard things. And I know that's not great coaching advice or, hey, learn the matchup zone or anything, but you got to start with that and go from there, because that to me is where it starts. So I guess that's what I'd say.
I want to thank everyone for tuning in to our first NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, and to the great Coach Tony Bennett for taking some time to also be with us. Good luck to the Cavaliers this year, Tony, as you get into your season. And to those that are listening and those that want to learn more about the NABC, you need only visit thenabc.com.